Is Donald Trump going to meet the Queen?
This is London Calling.
I'm Graham Mack and welcome to the programme. My guest this week is the American rock singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist and actress Suzi Quatro. And she was great. She invited me to her rock star mansion in the Essex countryside. And we sat in her kitchen and we talked about her life and her career and some personal moments too, including some of her regrets.
I was scared. I didn't think about it at that time. I just thought, get rid of it, until a little bit later. And now it's something I carry the stigma of that on me forever. I can only put it down to fear. Just fear. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I was petrified. But it's not a nice feeling. I feel sorry for any woman who has to make that decision. I don't think it's anything you ever get over. And then when you have kids, all you ever think about is who that would have been. It's not easy. But when you're, it's not, I'm not the first girl to have done that at that age. You know, I got caught. He was married. And I made the decision. Not happily. Not happily.
Suzi Quatro, coming up later. Now, there's been a lot of reaction to Donald Trump becoming president. Here's what Yoko Ono posted online this week. My definition of art is if it moves you, it's art, which means anything from a cool car to a nice painting to a footballer scoring a goal, that's art. And the people who create that are artists. I have to say I was moved by that. I think she's nailed it. I think of all the things that commentators and political pundits have said about the Donald Trump election victory, I think maybe Yoko has made more sense than anybody else and has connected with us more than anybody else. Maybe I finally understand the work of the tortured genius Yoko Ono. It's not just that Donald Trump is president for me. It's that Barack Obama is not president. I just think he's the coolest president America has ever had. He's just full of cool. And it's such a shame that America had its first black president, and now it's got Donald Trump. Orange is the new black. And it looks like the Queen wants to welcome Donald Trump to Windsor Castle. According to the British press this week, a state visit is on the cards for next year. Which kind of makes sense, because Donald Trump and the Queen have got a lot in common. They both live in houses where the walls are lined with gold. Their wealth and positions are as a result of an accident of birth. And they both give powerful jobs to their own children. So maybe this is the answer. Maybe Trump could do what our Queen does and step aside. Our head of state is the Queen. And as we know, the Queen does nothing. Members of the royal family do nothing. People say, oh, they work very hard. They don't. They do a lot of PR for themselves. Hate to tell you this, if you're a fan of the royals, but when they show up at an event that's a charity, they don't give a rat's arse about that charity. The most beloved royal of all, Princess Diana, is proof of that. She was involved with all those charities, AIDS charities and everything. In her will, she left them nothing. She did not leave a penny to any charity. They use the charities to get PR for themselves. That's not work. Any other business, they do the work the business does, and on the back of that, they do a bit of PR. The royals, all they do is PR for themselves. They don't do any work. PR is not work. So, in America, the head of state actually does something. They have a job and does PR when they feel like it. Because to be honest, the Queen doesn't do that much PR these days. She's really taken a back seat. She's just a nice old lady. So, if he became like the monarch head of state, he could get Mike Pence, who is a politician, knows the system, kind of would have a clue. That's what he should do. Then Trump could go round waving, get himself a Pope-mobile. He could show up at events, wave, pull little strings, curtains open, show off little plaques. And the great thing about the royals, and the reason why this, Great Britain, is great, is because the royals are not allowed to say anything political. They're not allowed. If we had Donald Trump not allowed to say anything political, not doing anything, we've got the model right here that could save the world. This week it was revealed that only one person has been prosecuted for smoking in a car while children are in that car. This is a law that came in last year. Floyd, you got something to say about this?
Smoking in a car. There's a law against it, right?
Yeah.
Why isn't there a law against pregnant women smoking if there's a law against secondhand smoke in a car?
Yes, that seems unfair. You're absolutely right.
There's a baby on board. Pregnant women who are smoking, first-hand smoke.
Yes.
Because I see this at work all the time, like this.
Yeah.
There's a pregnant woman and she's smoking, and I don't understand it.
No.
I don't understand why there's a law against secondhand smoke
in a car,
but there isn't a law against that. I don't get it. I just wanted to say that quickly.
No, that is a good point. If you can't have kids, you can't smoke when there's kids in the car. But you can smoke if there's a kid in your womb. What's that all about? In Britain, we're still very connected to the Commonwealth, so we're really interested in what's been happening in New Zealand, where they've had an earthquake. Demelza Leslie is a senior political reporter for Radio New Zealand. She's on the phone now. You're based in Wellington. Were you there when the quake hit?
Yes, it happened just after midnight, so like most other people, I was in bed when it hit, which may be just as well, perhaps, that limited the damage that actually occurred. So it was quite a rough awakening, to be honest. Almost heard it hit before the house started shaking, but it was a goodie. I mean, we do have earthquakes on a regular basis, but they're generally quite little ones, and so, you know, it doesn't cause you to run under a doorway or anything, but this one was a goodie, and it lasted for a good couple of minutes. So, you know, the panic really sets in after a while, and it really, at my own house, it only sent things flying off the shelves, but in a number of other houses, they've got, you know, glass broken, bookcases fallen over, huge amount of damage, or even in Kaikoura itself, there's been some houses that have been completely flattened.
Wow. Now, Wellington, yeah, as you say, used to earthquakes, and a lot of the buildings there are built to earthquake codes and quite modern buildings by UK standards. So Wellington, the capital,
well,
is quite...
Well, you think
so. Oh, really? It was,
yes,
a surprise, was it?
Actually, yes, over the past few days. Well, initially after the earthquake, 60 buildings in Wellington City were condemned until they were assessed by engineers. And since then, there may be half a dozen that staff members and apartment dwellers are not allowed into because they haven't passed tests. One is going to have to be completely demolished. There is a high-rise office block that's going to have to be demolished because there's an actual internal structural beam that's been majorly damaged. But what one of the most interesting things is, our defence headquarters in Wellington has suffered extensive damage. That's a four-year-old building too.
Wow.
So you'd think it would have the highest structural in it. But and so they're apparently not going to be back in that building for at least a year while it gets fixed.
Time to rewrite those building codes then, eh? Yeah, okay.
It sounds like it, that's right. And I think the government at the moment are quickly reassessing what legislation we have for building standards. But I suppose, how do you protect yourself against a huge quake like that? The magnitude of it has been risen quite a lot, or, you know, revised over the past few days, and now it's been set at 7.8. And so that's a really big shake, and we haven't had one like that in the capital for, hundreds of years.
Yeah, so that's Wellington. So you're at the bottom of the North Island. The centre of the earthquake was near the top of the South Island in Kaikoura. Mm. What's the situation there?
Well, Kaikoura is just a small tourist rural town. It really relies heavily on tourists and also its fisheries, and that's been completely cut off. It has a major arterial route, the State Highway 1, that connects it to, you know, neighbouring towns, and huge slips have closed that road, so that's been completely isolated since Monday's quake. They've had to use Navy frigates as well as helicopters to get in supplies, but also to get people out of the area, because they had hundreds of tourists stranded, quite a number from the UK as well. And in the past day, they sent the New Zealand's Canterbury frigate there to load up hundreds of tourists and take them so they can, you know, obviously be in a safer place and somewhere where there's running water, power, sewage, that kind of thing, because as soon as a quake hit, all that infrastructure was, you know, severely damaged.
And how important has Radio New Zealand been to the people there?
Well, we are the public broadcaster, so we're the lifeline. So we, you know, whenever emergencies hit, we have requirements on us to obviously broadcast as much as we can and much, you know, public service information. So as soon as the quake hit, we were, well, our newsreader was still on air reading a news bulletin when it actually hit, and she was incredible, to be honest.
Yeah.
She just sort of said, oh, look, it seems like we're being hit with a very strong quake here. And she managed just to carry on. It was incredible. And from there, we went live 24-7,
right,
just pretty much on the earthquake, because we had the threat of tsunamis as well.
Yeah.
And they had had to evacuate a number of people to higher ground.
Now, Kiwis...
They didn't really eventuate, but yeah.
Kiwis are famous for their resilience and their Kiwi ingenuity. I'm guessing a lot of the farmers and a lot of the cow cockies will be helping people out and just pitching in, and the community spirit will be something tremendous. In your estimation...
Yeah, they certainly are, borrowing generators from neighbours.
Are they?
Walking their cows across the road to a neighbour that might have a generator on their, you know, milking shed that they can use. So,
yeah
there is a lot of neighbourhood support happening.
In your estimation, I mean, you were there with the last time New Zealand had a big earthquake a few years back in Christchurch. Mm. How long before that area of New Zealand gets back to normal? I'm saying this for people who might be planning a trip down under.
Yeah, they're not certain yet on the time frames. I do know that Hamner Springs is open, that you can get in there, and that's quite a big tourist destination. I think Kaikoura, where there's a lot of whale watching and other tourist activities like that, that might take some time, I think, especially for the roads to reopen. They will open an inland road, but it's quite windy and it takes a long time to get there. But I think that the Prime Minister, he's our Tourism Minister, John Key, and I think he's pretty determined that this is going to happen at a quick rate, because he realises how much the country, let alone Kaikoura itself, actually relies on tourism. So they're going to have to do something and, you know, pull a rabbit out of a hat, basically, to get this town back up and running in a great hurry.
I know New Zealand will bounce back. Damelza Leslie, Senior Political Reporter for Radio New Zealand, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
This week in Britain, the BBC held its annual Gillard Awards. These are the awards for BBC local radio. And BBC Radio Merseyside won 4 awards. That's the radio station that serves Liverpool and the surrounding area, where I happen to have been born. And one of the things they played at the awards was a poem by the Liverpool poet Roger McGough. I got this thanks to Trevor Dan and his excellent Radio Today podcast. And it's a poem about Radio Merseyside. I'm pretty sure it was commissioned in 2008, because I'd heard about that, a poem about the radio station from 2008, which was a big year in Liverpool. It was named the European City of Culture. And I just think this poem captures everything about that radio station and about what local radio can do. Just so you get some of the references here, 1967 is the year that Radio Merseyside first went on the air. Hillsborough and Heysel are disasters where people were killed at football matches featuring Liverpool Football Club. The European Cup is the biggest prize in European football, and when Liverpool win it, and they've won it 5 times, the city goes crazy. Bulger is a toddler who was murdered. Bigley refers to Kenneth Bigley, who was a Liverpool civil engineer who was kidnapped in Iraq and beheaded. The Phil and the Everyman are theatres, and the Walker and the Tate are art galleries. This is Roger McGough and his poem about BBC Radio Merseyside.
I am the voice that announces you are not alone. I speak your language, I am homegrown. I am the gift of the gab, I am the quiet word, I am the night watch and the early bird. I am the cat's whisker, I am your favourite song. I invite you to dance and to sing along. I am on your wavelength, on your side of the street. I am with you in triumph and in defeat. I am Hillsborough, Heysel, the European Cup, the phantom caller who won't hang up. I am Bulger, I am Bigley, I am floods of tears. I am the Beatles, the Pope, the smiles and the cheers. I am the Phil, the Everyman, the Walker, the Tate. I am 1967 and 2008. I am the bijou apartment, the sheltered accommodation, the helping hand and the information. I am your voice. I am your ear to the ground. I am the pool of life and the Mersey sound. I am the cut ribbon, the champagne popped. I am the close down. The poem stopped.
Liverpool poet Roger McGough. Let's meet this week's guest. She's an American who's been living in England since the early 70s. Susie Quattro, a rock star, singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist and actress. She was the first female bass player to become a major rock star. She invited me to her Elizabethan mansion in the Essex countryside. We sat in her kitchen with only the sound of a central heating boiler clicking in and out. And I started by congratulating her on her honorary doctorate, which she'd been given by Cambridge University about a week before. So now Susie Quattro is a doctor of music.
I'm amazed.
How cool is that?
I keep signing my letters and telling everybody, Dr. Quattro. First thing I said to somebody, they said they wanted to talk to me, and I said, make an appointment.
Now, you're born in 1950 in a reasonably nice suburb of Detroit. What was growing up there like?
It was fabulous. It's, you know, we weren't rich, but we were, I guess, middle class. We lived on a street that everybody had like five kids and, you know, mixed, you know, I mean, Hungarian, Italian in my family. But in Grosse Pointe, you have all the rich people from the car industry. And my father, although he wasn't that rich, he did two jobs to ensure that we could grow up in this beautiful place called Grosse Pointe Woods. Beautiful. What a privileged childhood, you know. Of course, you don't know it at the time, but beautiful.
And what were the two jobs?
He was an engineer at General Motors in the daytime, and he played music at night his whole life. So he was up from 5 in the morning till midnight every day.
And it was a musical family.
Huge, yeah, huge. We all... I play classical piano and drums, percussion. I can read and write both those, and I taught myself bass. And it's not even a bragging thing because everybody in the family can play and read and write two or three instruments. So it's just how we were raised.
And you were one of five, second youngest.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to compete for mom and dad's attention?
Yeah, how can you possibly spread attention equally to five kids? I always say it's not possible. And I believe I wrote about that in my book. I needed just that little bit more, hence my character. You know, hence my character. And I think by the time I came along, my mom was going, oh, another girl. She really wanted one more boy, you know. And then when Nancy came along, that was the last baby. My mother really wanted a boy, but of course, babies are babies. So I think I was just another girl, and that's what I felt like, you know. And it's all perception, though. And maybe I needed to feel like that for me to be pushed where I was going.
You mentioned the book, Unzipped, which is a terrific read. As soon as I finished it, I tweeted, this is one of the best biographies I've ever read.
Thank you. Why?
Because it covered your career and your upbringing, but you were very open in parts about the relationship with your parents. It came across that your parents were very loving.
Oh, really loving.
But at times,
found your success difficult to deal with, especially they had you had four other siblings.
Yeah.
There was a time in the book when you say you went back to Grosse Pointe and you were very famous. I think you'd already been on Happy Days.
Yeah, that was the year I went back for Christmas. I was very famous by that point, yeah.
Yeah, and
that wasn't easy.
Was it Len, your husband at the time, who overheard a conversation with a reporter?
Oh, when he called, yes. He called up to speak to me at the family home. And my dad started telling him that he should be speaking to my brother instead.
I mean, your brother's a talented guy.
Yeah, but I mean, whoa. Whoa. I mean, I've come to terms with all that stuff, but I think my dad had the attitude that all of his kids are equal, and if one person made it, the rest should go along with him. And I tried that route with my sisters. I was in a band, always knowing that I was going to be picked out and taken away. You know, you have the instinct in you as a performer, and it's got nothing to do with ego, just being honest. I always knew there was something there that was going to make me be singled out. I believed that from day one, and yeah. I was proved right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's hard to take in a family when everybody's in the business.
Yeah.
That's really hard. I can understand it big time, you know, big time. But it still goes on a little bit now, and now I'm a little bit not so understanding, and now I think you had plenty of time to get over this.
Yeah.
You know, enough now. So I'm not so tolerant. I used to always mind my P's and Q's and try not to brag and try not to rub it in anybody's face and try not to enjoy my fame. And now I enjoy it because I've earned it.
Yes, you have.
Yes, I have.
So to answer your question, what I liked about the book was how much you shared in there about your feelings and things that maybe other people would leave out. And maybe because I have it in a much, much smaller way, a similar feeling with my parents. I'm only from one of two.
Oh, so you related to it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because I got into radio quite late in life. I was 27 mm-hmm. when I got into radio. Mm-hmm. And if I'm on the phone to my mother and I say, I spent an hour with John Cleese and I interviewed John Cleese, the first thing she'll say is something that my sister did, you know, almost to even it out.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I wasn't bragging. I was just saying it was really cool and I wanted to share.
I know parents do this. They do. they do. I mean, I remember the best one, I think it's in my book, that one where it really brought it home to me, actually with a sense of humor. Was I called my dad and I said, Dad, I just won Rear of the Year. You know, I've always had a great ass. What can I say? It's the truth. Since a little girl, I heard people say it and I think, what are you talking about? What constitutes a great ass? And my dad said, oh, yeah, well, all you kids have great asses. I went, what? I called him up and I said, Dad, the other three girls have big, wide hips.
You said that?
I actually called him out. I usually didn't say anything, but this time I did. I said, you know, if nothing else, can I just have this one myself? You know?
Yeah.
And the next time he was over, he said, hey, you know, you're right, Susie. I said, thanks. But they're not those kind of shapes.
No.
They're just not.
No.
Why can't you just say, well done, Susie? I mean, it's not like it's not like being a doctor, is it? I mean, Rear of the Year is not like being a doctor.
So what's the difference between Susie Quattro and Little Susie from Detroit? Now, I ask this because in the book, Little Susie from Detroit...
All the way through.
Yeah, she keeps coming back.
And she always will.
Yes.
And she always will.
So what is the difference?
When I was first sitting down to write this book, it didn't make sense until... Because I am a Gemini, I'm very Gemini, so I have lots and lots of sides. Not sides, just splinters of my personality. Once I started to write as Little Susie, everything kind of fell out. I thought, yes, because there is Little Susie, this little girl from Detroit City, you know, sweet. My mom always called me sweet. And friends of mine always that know me well, they say, sweet. When I got my doctor award, my husband, he said, sweet. So I'm sweet. In nature, I'm sweet. Then you've got this one. But even that is sweet in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a sweetness there.
You know, those first clips of you doing Can the Can on Top of the Pops, there's an innocence there. There's a charm and an innocence
there
that,
innocence.
Although you're in the leather,
yeah,
and you're vamping it with that huge bass that you're almost riding, but in the eyes, there's some that, and I think that's what made Susy Quattro so special. You know, you were also a pioneer as a lady of rock. But there were ladies of rock that came later. Chrissie Hynde, Joan Jett, who was a fan of yours.
Huge, yeah. She only took one element of my character, though.
Yeah.
She really tomboyed it. She really made it quite butch, and I'm not butch.
But there was something in your eyes.
Yeah, something in my eyes, because I had this... So what's the difference? And then I'll answer that in my eyes, because that's an interesting thing. Little Susie is... Right now, you're talking to Little Susie from Detroit, because Susy Quattro is on stage. And unless you particularly want me to be this one, I can easily switch tracks and be Susy Quattro, which is a different thing altogether.
This is radio. And radio is a little more intimate.
Yeah.
And a little more personal than stage.
Yeah.
So I would like Little Susy from Detroit.
I know, I prefer Little Susy from Detroit. She made Susy Quattro possible.
Was Susy Quattro born... sorry, you were going to talk about the eyes. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I was sitting one time with... Bruce Welch and a couple other people, and we had done a show together in Germany. We were talking in the bar afterwards, and we got onto my image. And then we got, you know how you do when you've had a drink. And I said, they all were saying, oh, we really love you. And I said, okay, so tell me something. I said, I'm curious, I'm going to pick your brains now. I said, did you ever think that I was trying to be sexy? And immediate, no, not at all. I said, was I ever threatening? No, not at all. I said, did I look like a girl showing you that I could be a guy? They said, no. I said, then what was it? They said, we don't know. It was just you. So it was a natural thing, but not trying to be sexy. This is why it worked.
Mm.
Mm. You couldn't say, oh, she's trying.
Mm.
You know, and I think if a girl was going to come along and change the lay of the land, which I did.
Yes, you did.
It had to be somebody like me. Who wasn't trying to prove being a woman and doing that, was just being herself. It took a very natural ingredient. That's the only way I can explain it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if that makes sense.
Was Susy Quattro born on the 6th of January 1957 when you were watching the Ed Sullivan Show?
I think so.
It was that big an impact that
huge,
Elvis had?
Huge. I have this one-woman show, which I'm hoping I'm going to be taken to Chichester soon. I've already done it on the BBC. Big two-hour special for my 50th anniversary. It's my one-woman show called Unzipped, and I talk about that in there. And it's about 8 or 9 epiphanies. They're all in the book. But this one, never forget it. Never forget it. Ed Sullivan Show, the show to watch, a family show, a variety show. And right at the end, he would always introduce something, he said, for the youngsters. And out comes Elvis Presley. I'm 6. Everybody's gathered around. The one oldest in me is 15, the girl. So she's just the right age. So he comes on, don't be cool, and she starts screaming. Now, part of me looks at her and goes, why are you screaming? You know, I'm a little girl. Then I turned to the TV and it went, boink. Just boink. And I went, that's what I'm going to do.
You knew straight away.
I always say, may God strike me down. I'll never forget it. Something went in and stayed in. So he directly reached out and grabbed me. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I found my path all that time ago.
And at that time, there were no girls doing that. Did that even cross your mind?
No. Didn't even cross my mind. I always say that. Isn't that, why wouldn't it? Isn't that kind of crazy? That's what I mean. I'm a one-off. You know? That I didn't think, oh, he's a guy. I didn't think about it. I just thought, I'm doing that. You know? That's kind of crazy.
Well, while we're on Elvis... Your leather stage outfits, were they inspired by what Elvis wore in the 68 comeback special?
What, 100%?
Yeah.
I started the band at 14 with my sisters, one of my sisters. No, then two of my sisters. We all sort of went chopped and changed. And I saw the comeback special.
Right.
And I decided leather was my thing. Again, another epiphany. And I went out and I bought a leather jacket the next day, my first leather jacket. So this goes all the way through my life, these connections. You know, it's crazy. Remind me to give you a copy of Singing with Angels, too.
Okay. That's yeah, my tribute. That's the one about Elvis. It's the song
about
Elvis. Yeah,
done with James Burton and the Jordanaires. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah, wow.
Give me a break.
Wow. Okay, let's fast forward to February 64, Ed Sullivan Show again. Four blokes from my hometown. What kind of impact did
they
have?
Are you from there?
Yeah.
From wow, Liverpool, where's your accent?
It's from all over. I lived, when I was 18, my parents emigrated to New Zealand. And I lived there
for
7 years.
I'm hearing
a little
bit of that.
And then I met my wife there. We've been married 30 years next year. And we moved to Australia together. And we lived in Australia for six and a half years.
Yeah, I hear a bit of both.
And I've been back all over Britain since 97.
Yeah, so it's
all mixed up. Yeah.
Okay, so 64, that's the second time we were... That another epiphany, that was the Beatles. And we all called each other on the phones, you know. Everybody on an extension. We called two friends.
You were waiting for them then. The hype.
We're waiting for them. Waiting for them again.
It's not like Elvis was a surprise.
We were just watching the variety show.
Yeah.
And on came Elvis, and I just really was like, wow, what? Like I got hit with something. The Beatles, we knew they were coming on.
Yeah.
So we were watching.
Yeah.
And as soon as they were finished, we ran and called two friends of ours who were sisters, and another girl just three houses down whose father played in my dad's band. And we started screaming, and I remember because Patty said, my eldest sister, one next to me, she said, why don't we form an all-girl band? And we all went, yeah, great idea.
Right, so there had to be a band then. And that's that. When you saw there were four of them, it had to be a band. You'd seen Elvis.
Band, all-girl band.
Right, all-girl band. Yeah.
And I didn't care if it was girls. I never cared about it being girls or not. I just cared about it being a band. And everybody grabbed an instrument. And nobody grabbed the bass.
Right.
So I was right at the end of all the babbling going on. I was on one of the phones and I said, hey, because everybody was talking over each other. I want the drums. I play lead. I'll play piano. I say, hello. And Patty said, you're going to play bass. I went, okay. Even though I already played piano and percussion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was there a bass in the house?
Yeah, my dad had one. He gave me a 1957 Fender Precision.
Right.
The best.
Yeah.
But and heavy, the hardest and the biggest.
With a big wide neck.
Yes.
And heavy too.
Yes.
I mean, you're not that tall now.
No, I'm not.
You know.
No, it was quite crazy that I have given this bass that on end stands about up here on me. Didn't even think about it. Honestly, put it on and I went, yeah. It was real perfect fit. And I didn't even know that the neck was a hard one to learn because I didn't know any better. So I just learned it. I can't play a small bass. You know, my arms are...
You never thought of switching to something lighter like that hollow body thing that McCartney plays? No, you wanted the big one.
I told Paul I didn't like that bass.
Really?
Yeah.
You told Paul McCartney you didn't like the Hofner violin bass.
And then when I got up from the floor, no, I didn't like it. I like a big, heavy, proper bass. He's more a guitar bass, you know. He started on guitar. I never went from guitar to bass. I started on bass. So for me, I'm a... bass player. Paul's very good, though.
Well, so I've heard.
It's in all
the papers.
Because I think he's a little bit underrated. I mean, he's just one of the Beatles, but I think he's a very good guitar, very, very good bass guitarist. Very good.
And your style, that low slung style, where you almost ride the thing, where did that come from?
I saw a guy called Ronnie Magoo, who was in a band called the Blues Magoos. 1964, so I was just beginning to learn it, getting on it, looking for my stance, looking for my style. And there was they were like a psychedelic band from New York, and we went to see them live in Detroit. And he had it down low, and they were pumping away, and it was like a psychedelic experience. And I thought, that's me. You know, any good performer, you take in your energies, you know, like Joan Jett saw me, and she went, okay, that's who I am, and I want to use that. All good performers do it. You swallow what can go through you and come out your way. So I knew that was me, and I just slung it low, and I could just rock with it. It was great, absolutely great.
And what kind of stuff were the all-girl group, which is most of your sisters, the Pleasure Seekers, what kind of stuff were you playing?
We did covers. Obviously, we didn't have any hits. We wrote a lot of our own stuff. Oh, that was in the second wave of the band. And we did different sets because you had to do five shows a night. So we would do a Motown set, being from Detroit. We'd do a Beatles set. We'd do a Top 40 set. We'd do a hippie set, you know. So we had different things. I was the lead singer. I was the bass player. I was the front person. I sang 98.9% of the songs. All the guy songs I sang. Any girl songs my sister sang.
Yeah. And that was just, what was that reason? Just
because I had the balls to sing them. She said sweetly. Sorry. I'm flying up. And there you go.
And what was the first gig like?
We knew three songs.
Okay.
Latin Dubilu, Twist and Shout, and Long Tall Tex, and all in the same three chords. And we were playing at the local dance hall, the Hideout. And that was coming home. I stood up there on that stage and I went, I said, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Here we are.
At what age?
14.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Nothing else matters now.
I fell in love with it. Fell in love with entertaining.
And then how long till you got a record deal?
I was 16, I think, and we were signed to Mercury Records first. We put out one single or two singles with them. I can't remember. They didn't make it. But we were a very popular working act because we were girls. So the clubs always wanted to book us because we brought the customers in. So we were always, always, always working, even though we had no record success. And it was a great time to learn.
Yeah.
Those different kinds of music, you know, and
yeah.
And going sometimes just to the front and just singing, not very often, but sometimes, and then going to the drums for a couple numbers. And it was real good homework. I learned how to entertain the drunk in the bar, you know? Really.
Yeah.
I have a really good repartee with whoever. You can throw me anything, you're not gonna get past it. You know? End of story.
You're not gonna win.
You develop it.
Yeah.
Because you always got to keep control of the audience, you know? So if you get a smart ass, you better take control.
I'm guessing a girl group would get more of that kind of hassle.
Oh, you get that jerky take it off stupid stuff, which I can't even be bothered to. Uh-huh. Can't even dignify it with a smart comment, you know? It's just too basic. But I think the worst one was one time we were at this club and it was where I went back to the drums. And the drummer, who had a very good voice, came out and sang Summertime. And I was playing away, and I looked here, and there was two risers with go-go dancers.
Yeah.
And they had no tops on. I'm going, what am I doing playing in a band? And there are two girls. No, they did one number with no. This is the stuff you learn.
Yeah.
Being in an all-girl band in the 60s. I didn't like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, didn't like that.
And you hung out with a lot of the other bands at the time. Which ones do you remember hanging out with?
Well, we played with them all. MC5. Amboy Dukes.
MC5, wow.
Cool. Grand Funk Railroad. Iggy Pop, I knew him when he was still a drummer. Alice Cooper, still a good friend today. Bob Seger, did loads of gigs with him. He was great. He was great. I thought he was a strange guy because he would come in and just either with an acoustic guitar or just sit at a piano and do his own songs at a gig. And I think, wow. Wow, that's unusual. And mm-hmm. Boy, the guy's got talent.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could hear it. This is at a rock and roll Detroit gig.
Yeah.
And he'd come in and do his own thing. And I,
He got the respect from the audience when he did
he
that?
He got the interest.
Yeah.
Everybody had the same you know? I mean, they're not going to cheer because they don't know the songs, but everybody stopped and listened.
Mm-hmm.
So he was winning, as indeed he did.
Then the Pleasure Seekers relocated to New York. How important was that?
We got our first gig there, I think I was 15, just going on 16, at Trudy Hiller's in Greenwich Village. And that was your five sets a night. Five sets a night. Pay attention, you youngsters in the industry today, when you complain over five songs a night, you know? This is five sets a night.
And how long was each set? About 45?
45 minutes on, 15 minutes off. You're talking a lot of playing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And that's why today's musicians can't do what I can do. I can get up and jam with anybody. I can get up and jam jazz with somebody if I choose it. It's just called learning it. When you play that much, I mean, the Beatles could do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And they came from even though they're the era before me, they came from the time when you had to do lots of sets a night. Yeah. And this is actually how you become very good at what you do. There's no substitute.
What do you think then of young bands? Well, let's say the stars who make it through X Factor and things like that, where they have all week to rehearse one song.
They have all week to rehearse a song that applauds mediocrity. They're not applauding invention. They're not applauding creation. They're applauding somebody doing somebody else's song who's already done it and made it into a big thing. Sure, they might twist it and put it their own way, but I think, sorry to say, I think reality shows have a lot to answer for. And I've been saying it for years. I've been saying it for years and years. I won't be a hypocrite, though. I enjoy watching them. Absolutely. But just for the entertainment value, but I don't think it's how stars are found. I mean, who's Honey G? I am amazed. I don't want to put her down. Bless her. I have nothing against her. I don't know her. But what? It's supposed to be a singing competition? And she doesn't even rap well. So what is she? Is it the comic element? It is like that guy in Strictly? Mm-hmm. That they always have a funny one?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it makes it disreputable. And I don't think stars are found that way. I think the ones that have made it that we know about from the reality shows, there's a few that have come through those ranks and are famous now mm-hmm. and do very well. I think those particular ones would have made it without the reality show. I think they would have got through somehow.
Right.
But there's a lot of them. If I said, you know, so-and-so, you say no, they won.
Right, yeah.
That answers my question.
Yeah.
So they do applaud mediocrity.
Yeah.
Like I said, but some do get through. You see, like Leo and Lewis, great, you know? Yeah. One Direction, they're very famous. Little Mix, I'm not so sure about. I don't know if I like them that much. But a few got through. What's that? Carrie Underwood?
Yeah.
So there's a few, but these are the odd ones, you know? These shows have been going a long time. And you can maybe name six or seven. And that's it. And every year has a winner and runner-ups. So you never hear from them again.
Mm.
So how can that be searching for a star?
Yeah.
It's television. And there's nothing wrong with it, but call it what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're working hard in New York. You're doing your five sets a night. Your parents are very supportive, but your dad punched Chuck Berry.
I saw him not that long ago. We were in Buffalo, New York, and we were obviously supporting Chuck Berry. He was on after us. And one of the girls, long blonde hair and quite big-chested. And anyway, we were watching, and then we went back in the dressing room, and Chuck Berry came off the stage from his show. And he was only honestly fooling around. He was fooling around. He didn't mean anything. He grabbed the blonde, and he was playing and threw her on the couch messing around. And my dad happened to walk in at that point.
Yeah.
So he just went, wallop. I said, Dad, you just knocked out Chuck Berry.
What was Chuck's reaction?
Well, he was a bit shocked, but he didn't do anything. He just got up and walked into his room. He didn't say anything, but I saw him years later in Munich.
Yeah.
And I went backstage and I said, hi, and he said hi, he knew who I was. And then he put it together because I saw him looking. He must have followed a little bit, you know, known that. And I said, do you remember Buffalo, New York, 1967? He said, immediately went, yes. Remember the pledges? Because he went, yes. I said, remember my dad hitting you? He said, yes. Oh, God. No, he was fine. He was fine. He said, I won't forget that.
So now you talk about this in your book, and it's okay if you don't want to talk about it here. I only bring it up because it was in the book. When you were 17, you fell in love with a married man. At 18, you're pregnant. And you had an abortion.
Yeah, scared shitless I was, actually. Yeah.
But a big decision to make that young.
Huge. Huge.
Why did you decide the timing?
Yeah, and I'm a Catholic girl. And, you know, yeah, I'm a Catholic girl, and I'm really strong on my beliefs. But I was scared. I didn't think about it at that time. I just thought, get rid of it! Until a little bit later. And now it's something I carry the stigma of that on me forever. I can only put it down to fear. Just fear. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I was petrified. But it's not a nice feeling. I feel sorry for any woman who has to make that decision. I don't think it's anything you ever get over. And then when you have kids, all you ever think about is who that would have been. It's not easy. But when you're, it's not, I'm not the first girl to have done that at that age. You know, I got caught. He was married. And I made the decision. Not happily. Not happily. It's a regret, and I don't usually have regrets, but that one I do. Maybe I'll meet him again on the other side. Him.
Oh, you know?
No, I don't know. But I think it must have been. I think it must have been a him. I always call him a him. Yeah. Oh, bless.
Then you met the legendary producer, Mickey Most. Mm-hmm. Take me through what happened when you met Mickey.
My brother found out that he was coming to town.
For those who don't know, Mickey had produced...
Mickey Most.
Yeah, Lulu, The Animals.
Donovan. I mean,
he was a
Jeff
hit maker.
Beck.
He was a dream maker.
Yeah, huge. Yeah. Huge. And then he started his own record company in the early 70s. My brother, who was kind of being a promoter at that stage and doing a lot of big shows, my dad said, why don't you help your sisters out? So he was helping us out a little bit, putting us on some of his big outdoor festivals. And he found out that Mickey Most was in town soon to record with Jeff Beck at Motown. So he got in touch with him. And he said, why don't you come and see the all-girl band? And he agreed to. So we went up there, I always remember, in Easttown Ballroom. And it was in Cradle, which was the second wave of the Pleasure Seekers. And
so you wanted to get a bit more serious. So
yeah, yeah. We started to write. To write songs and all that. And then I got shoved to the back. Which is interesting. Patty and, well, all of us, we talked. And because the Pleasure Seeker had done a gig at an outdoor festival and we didn't go down very well. So we went home and had a big, serious discussion. Da, 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 da. And Patty said, why don't we bring in Nancy? She's young, vibey. I thought, yeah, good idea. She can sing very mm-hmm. well. And then she said, maybe you should take a back seat. Now, I think that was Patty's jealousy. She wanted to take me back seat. That's how I see it now. But, you know, you still couldn't keep me down because even in the back seat, just singing two songs, Mickey signed me, so it proves it.
So that's when you weren't out front.
No.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
But Nancy was singing, and then I did my two. One of them I wrote, and one was Jarrah House Rock. So again, Elvis connection.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember he was sitting, I could see him sitting back. And Nancy had been singing, we're playing all our originals, and I said, here's one I wrote, all attitude. And I did all the Lonely People. And then I went into going to a party at the county jail. And he just said, so that's it. Two songs, went back, played the bass. And at the end of the show, I could see him. He went like this, come to me.
Yeah.
And I went back, sat with him in the seats. And he said, how would you like to make an album? And I said, yeah. I said, who are you? I knew who he was. He said, Mickey Most. I said, oh, what do you do? I'm a producer. Oh. He said, so why don't you come to Motown with me and see how it's done? I said, sure. So I went with him, Jeff Beck, Cozy Powell, to Motown. And the girls went home. So all of a sudden I'm with Mickey, you know?
Did you know at that stage that he wasn't talking about the whole band?
I had a feeling, but No. To be quite honest, I didn't know at that stage. But he was showing an interest in me. But I didn't think at that stage it was just me. I thought it was the band, but maybe he liked me the best out of it. You know, not that he just wanted me. There's two different things. So we went to Motown, and I saw a bass down in the pit, you know. And mm-hmm. I went down, picked it up, and Cozy came down, and Jeff came down, and we jammed to Funk 49.
You jammed with Cozy Powell and Jeff Beck. That was your audition for Mickey Most. Although yeah. It sounds like he was most of the way there anyway.
Yeah. So we jammed in the pit.
Wow.
At Motown. And then it was just the three guys, and I kind of was going, I don't like being here on my own. So I left it for just a few minutes more. I was looking at the studio and watching them do what they do, and I called the girls, and I said, come get me. So they came down to Motown and got me. Right. And Mickey gave me his address and all that. He said, send me some tapes and we'll see what we can do. And he didn't say anything to me at that stage. But he called my brother the next day, who had arranged it. And he said, come to New York. So my brother came to New York. And he said, I'm only interested in Susie. You know, uh-oh.
I mean, your sisters are in this band.
Hmm?
You've got sisters in this band.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Not easy.
No, this is a family.
Really? Not easy. He said, I only want Susie. So then Mickey came back and told, this story's been going on forever, and there's been 8 zillion versions of it, but I tend to believe my brother's version because he has no ulterior motive. And he was the one. And when he tells it, and he tells it to me straight, I go, okay, your version washes with me. And with Mickey, too, who told me that, yes, he had told Mickey. So my brother came back and he told my dad and he told Patty and I think he told all the girls except for me. Nobody talked to me. They all talked amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it was said, somebody said, shall we tell her? And I think Patty said, Mickey said, Patty said, no, let's see if we can get him to take the whole band, which is fair enough.
Yeah.
When you think about it, you know, try to push him that way. So the decision was made not to tell me anything about it. And we kept sending Mickey tapes and rehearsals and different things. We weren't getting anywhere. And the band was kind of going down, 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 down. And then the band was on verge of breaking up. And I went to Arlene's house, who had left the band. She's this one that had been married 7 times. And yeah, she had another person to marry, so she left the band. But I went over to her and I said, oh my God, Arlene, the band's breaking up. Oh my God, I'm so depressed. It's been my whole life. What am I going to do? And she said, call Mickey. I said, why? She said, because he wants you. I said, what? He has a shock on my face. What? I said, I didn't know that. She said, oh yeah, call him. So I called Mickey and I said, hi. He took my call immediately. I said, hi. He said, it's Susie. He said, how are you? I said, fine. I said, the band is breaking up. He said, good. Come to England. Let's make an album.
Well, Susie did go to England. She did make that album. She had many hit singles through the 70s and 80s and beyond. Then she went back to the US, had hits there too, and appeared in 15 episodes of Happy Days. Hear more in part 2 of my interview with Susie Quattro. That's in 2 weeks' time, right here on London Calling. Next week, my guest is a Brit who made it in the States. It's the broadcaster Simon Conway, who's a conservative talk show host on WHO in Iowa. He's interviewed Donald Trump and all of the Republican presidential hopefuls. What does he think about the prospect of Trump as president? And how do they heal the rifts within the Republican Party that Trump has caused? Simon Conway, next week, right here on London Calling with me, Graham Mack. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mack. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, which is macmedia.co.uk. You can subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. If you've got a question or something to say, send me an email, put your phone number in the email, I might call you back or Skype you on the show. My address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next week, ta-da.